Welcome to Bee's Table Talk, the podcast in which we have great conversations about business and our economy. My name is Bee Kyle. I am the president and CEO of the St. Paul Area Chamber, and I'm really glad that you're with us today. I always enjoy these. This is my chance to have conversations with leaders among us doing great things within the community and with their own organizations. And this year, I'm delighted to invite our sponsor for this podcast. What a novel idea, right? Wells Fargo has chosen to really invest in this work. You know, this organization has a legacy of extraordinary engagement in this region, and they're investing in their priorities through their work and also through their individual leaders. So I'm delighted to partner with them on this and that they choose to support this little enterprise. So more to come on that. For today, though, my guest today is a very dear friend and a nationally recognized leader in the diversity, equity, and inclusion community. She currently is the Global Chief Inclusion and Diversity Officer at Medtronic and also the head of Medtronic's foundation. And her name is Dr. Sally Saba. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you as well, Bee. Thanks for having me here with you today. It's a pleasure.
Oh my gosh. My pleasure to get to introduce you to the community because you know how much I love you. So first of all, I do want to let folks just get a flavor of your perspective on things. So let's start with your history. You and your family are from Egypt. You earned your Doctor of Medicine and Surgery from Cairo University. Your MBA is from ESLSCA. You have to tell me what that is. Business School in Paris. So how in the world did you wind up in beautiful Minnesota?
Well, let me start off by saying I love you too, which is why I'm here with you today, because you're a very special, not only person, but leader, Bee. I love how you lead and all of the work that you do in the chamber. You have been one of the highlights for me as I have moved to Minnesota. Oh, so I'm happy to engage and give you a little bit of, you know, how did I end up here, which is a convoluted way. So yes, I was born in Egypt. You're taking me kind of down memory lane here a little bit. As I was growing up, a little tidbit for the listeners here, because this personal piece ties into who I am a little bit more. Mm-hmm. My mom, when she had me, I came out a girl, and she didn't want a girl, and so I was left behind with family to raise, and returned to her later when I was 3 years old. Mm. And so the reason I'm saying that is the reason I went to medical school to begin with was mm-hmm. I had this kind of desire to heal people. I felt a lot of pain as a child and wanted to be in the space of healing. And I thought being a doctor would, you know, help me do that. So I went to medical school in Egypt. Yes. And then there was this incident when I was finishing up, when I was in the middle of my residency program, mm-hmm. where I had a little bit of wouldn't call it an altercation, but a moment that is one of those pivotal moments in your life mm-hmm. That led me to decide to leave medicine and try to be part of fixing the medical industry or space altogether. Unfortunately, for personal reasons, I was going through a divorce at the time. And so I decided, you know, I'm gonna switch things up and go get a master's in business. So an MBA from ESLSCA and then joined. I needed to put food on the table for my daughter. I was a single mom. And so I just ended up going and getting a job to put food on the table and kind of left that dream of I'm going to fix the industry.
That's what we moms do, though. When you're a parent, you take care of business. Strategies, right? Step two, kids are step one. Get it? Yep. I'm with you on that. Yep.
So that was really just a what do I need to do now? So I took my MBA in business and moved into business, which was, you know, at the time, a telecommunications company called Vodafone. And built a career there. And when I was there, I met this guy, right? Sometimes there's a guy involved.
Yes, ma'am. That's called strategy number three. Yep.
Yeah. And he was really the reason I moved to the United States altogether. Mm-hmm. I would have not moved if not for him. We kind of fell in love, and he wanted me to move to the States so we build a family here. And in moving to the States, I didn't have the community and the people who know who I am. And, you know, my resume was from Egypt, and Americans kind of don't, you know, it's not as easy to infiltrate when you're from there. So I started my own business. I dabbled in a few things, and then the recession hit.
Mm.
Of course, life has to throw at you all the different things. Mm-hmm. So once the recession hit and I lost everything, in the small businesses we were working on, I decided to go back to what I know, which is the healthcare space.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I joined Kaiser Permanente, which is the largest nonprofit healthcare system in California. And I built a career there, and that's what led me to this space of diversity and inclusion. I never thought I would land or stay in that space necessarily, but I did fall in love with it for a variety of reasons. Maybe we'll go through later, but it is that journey that allowed me the expertise enough in this space that when Medtronic was looking for a chief inclusion diversity officer, I wanted to stay in the healthcare space in this work, back to my origins. And so it was an opportunity that came at the right time. And I took a leap of faith and moved to Minnesota in 2020.
Oh, speaking of 2020, so let's pause on that for a moment. Okay, Minnesota listeners. So this woman, she moves to Minnesota alone to take work in a big company where it's sometimes hard to plug in, to a region where it's sometimes hard to plug in during a pandemic when you are not allowed to plug in. So tell us, how was that first year for you? I mean, I don't want to be glib. It had to have been challenging.
Well, you know, you said all those things, and add to that the biggest social unrest this country had ever seen for somebody who's coming in to be the first chief diversity officer for a company of our size. So it was the perfect storm of everything. I think I still have a little PTSD from that year, or a lot of PTSD from that year. It was a very, very challenging year. I don't want to say bad words on a podcast, but to put it politely, I think it was one of the most challenging personally and professionally years I have ever experienced in my whole life. The only anchor I truly had is that I had started my own mental health journey prior in prior years. So my meditation practice and things like that are really what helped me get through. And another just bright light in that first 18 months was actually the event that you and the chamber put on. And any newcomers to this area, that was the first time, Bea, that I actually met people from outside my work, that event that you put on. So because it was COVID, because nobody was meeting, because nobody was inviting anybody to anything. So your event with, hey, execs from the region, come and meet each other, was my first coming out in Minnesota to the business community.
And for everyone listening, so our executive reception is just that. It's our desire. We track C-suite moves over the course of a year, thinking that, I mean, it's a lonely job. And I don't mean to be flip. It's you've got a big body of work. It's hard to meet other peers. You have a lot of responsibilities. Most people you talk to are either your boss or your team member. So, you know, where can you find your friends? And we chose to push the envelope, say, you know, these folks still want friends also, still want networks and relationships. And I remember I'm closing my eyes as I'm remembering that event, and Sally had walked in the room. There's about 150 people, and she was sitting by herself. And my board members know, I tell them, look, your role is to host. And I gave two of my board members the look. And I looked over at this woman sitting by herself, and I basically said, get over there and meet her. And we plugged her in. And of course, when I met her, for those of you who don't know, I met Sally and I'm like, oh, she's the sister I never had. Oh my gosh, this is so wonderful. And we made a friendship out of an introduction that was purely professional. And what a joy you have been for me. It's such a treat to see you and know that it was good for you too.
Likewise, B. You've been the highlight as a friend on this Minnesota journey. Mm-hmm. And I tell everybody about that event that you mm-hmm. and the Chamber had, because it was creative and innovative idea. And it really worked for those of us who were new here. Mm-hmm. The highlight was meeting you and building the beautiful friendship we now have, and the community leaders that I met and built other relationships with. So just please keep that going, because it was a really cool event and a really good way for people to get in community.
That's fabulous. So, and you and I have talked at length. So for all of you, I took Sally to her first Minnesota State Fair. We got to meet the Doobie Brothers. Ask Sally about that story someday. That's for another conversation. But we've gone to State Fair together and we've done several firsts. So when you think about, I love this state. And so when you think about your travails, you've been so many, such a globally traveled woman, and your perspective is so broad and you're so wise. When you look at your experience and then you have observed Minnesota and participated, outside of the things we've kind of talked about, what would you say has surprised you as you've settled here?
I love that question, because a lot did surprise me. And I love to hear your perspective. You know, do you agree with my observations or not? Because you're a world traveler as well, right? Through your veteran years and so forth. So, you know, I guess the first couple of things is, this was my first experience in a Midwest state, because I've lived on the East Coast, which has a flavor, and on the West Coast, which has a completely different flavor.
Right.
Yeah. So coming to the Midwest, there are two things that really stuck out to me the most. And you and I have talked about this over wine, where, you know, there's this level of wholesomeness that I have noticed in Minnesotans, which is actually really similar to the family-oriented type of culture that you find in Egypt, in a place like Egypt. Like, family is really important. Most people's friends come from within family. Like, your cousin is your friend, and this is, and you know, on weekends and things, that's who people are hanging out with. Like I was sharing with you, B, you know, when we went to the concert the first time, there are a lot of older couples here together.
Yes. Well,
that is an anomaly in California. Mostly now, when you go out, it's like, people haven't stuck together through their marriage. It's older men with maybe younger women, with just variety, a lot more variety than the wholesomeness of couples who seem to have lived together for a long time and stayed in marriage and so forth. The other big thing that really comes to mind is kindness. People here are very, very kind, easy to lend, you know, quick to lend a hand, to show kindness. And That is another thing that I have really appreciated about people in Minnesota.
You know, I will tell you, when I so many Minnesotans, I say, look, all you got to do is travel. Leave Minnesota for a hot minute. You won't talk about traffic anymore. You won't talk about how kind or not kind people are. You won't, there's lots of things we stop complaining about and go, oh my gosh, you know, this is really a lovely place to be, raise a family, invite new friends in. Yeah. We just need to practice the art of scooching, which I know we talk about, which is making room for more new people to love. I appreciate that perspective. And I want to ask more about you too, because as you and I talk a lot about our lives' journeys, and we're both at an age now where we're really reflecting and drawing some conclusions about our lives and perhaps developing some insights about a seemingly disorganized journey that wound up being this beautiful fabric of connectedness, which I find is really fun to be aware of. And there are inflection points in everyone's lives, turning points, decision points that we don't even realize at the time, but we take on a new challenge or they guide us to some new understanding. Can you share one or two inflection points in your life that has shifted you?
Absolutely, Bea. And, you know, as you were sharing that, What I've always also realized as an adult now, in my 50s, that if at the time the inflection point seems like a horrible and challenging thing, when we get to our age, then you look back and know that's why that felt that way.
Yes.
Or either I'm glad I stuck with my decision, or I understand why I had to go through that to get to here. Yeah. So, you know, I think for me, I have too many inflection points because I've changed careers and done so many things. But the couple that I'll share here, you know, the first one was because this was like a really, really big decision for me, which was I come from a family of all physicians. Which is why I was, you know, in medical school, everybody's physicians, da, da, da. So to leave medicine was a big deal. And when I decided to leave medicine, my family was already not talking to me because I married somebody they didn't approve of. And so I was kind of lone ranger there. And when I decided to leave, my ex-husband, my first ex-husband, actually locked me up in a room for 2 days. This is a true story. The grown-up woman. He locked me up in a room for 2 days so I can, you know, think and change my
mind. Think about it.
Yeah.
Right.
And when I was released from that room, I came out and said, I lost my family to marry you. I've made a decision. I'm leaving medicine and I don't care if that costs me you. And I had this, I don't know where I got that conviction from at the time, you know, being 29 or 30 or whatever, but I knew it was the right thing for me to do. And I had been through enough tribulation and things to know I've got to do what's right for me. And it, and it doesn't matter what other people are enforcing upon me anymore. So leaving medicine was a big thing. My ex did not leave me because of it, even though he threatened. I ended up leaving him for other reasons, maybe related to the fact that I get locked up in a room.
Hence the wine drinking we share later on in life, but that's aside.
Right. but leaving medicine was definitely a big deal because even when my family found out, they extended their, you know, I am no longer welcome as part of this family for choosing again to do something that is so against their will. But I did it, and I'm glad I did it. I left medicine. I left being a doctor. I did not intend to leave the industry. I just wanted to affect the industry differently. And all my cousins were doctors and I knew exactly what they were doing. And it was being a doctor. It wasn't changing industry. The second inflection point was here in the States. So after I came and I did my own things and then the recession, I had to go back to corporate. And so I had joined Kaiser Permanente as the first job was the director of product safety and recall. And it was a new job that they had. And it kind of fit because I had this business background with my MBA and then I was a doctor. So they thought, okay, this kind of can fit here. But then 9 months in, I'm bored. I've done I fixed everything that needed to be fixed. It's programmed, it's processed, everybody's aligned. And I'm telling my boss, you know, you guys are only using 30% of my brain capacity. I'm bored. Like, what else you got? That conversation was literally an inflection point that's probably the reason I'm sitting in this office today.
Right.
Because he said, well, we have the supplier diversity program. We don't know what to do with it. So could you take a look? And my first reaction was, why on earth would a company waste any time on something called supplier diversity? You know, you need a widget, you go buy it from J&J. Like, what are you doing?
Right.
Literally, that was my response. And he said, well, Sally, go do what you do, which is go learn what you need to learn and come back to me and tell me what you think we should be doing in this space. So I went and I took like 3 months and really educated myself about how the economies here in the United States really work and how big a part of that is the engine of small businesses.
Oh, like yes.
People think the big names, the Apples and the Microsofts, they're like less than 2% of all companies in the United States.
And the hiring and the investments and volunteering and the engagement. Yes. And yes.
It is all in small business.
Yes.
And not a lot of Americans know that that's the economic engine of this country.
Yeah.
And once I found out that and other pieces of information, I took on that job and put together a proposal for Kaiser Permanente to commit to $1 billion with minority and women-owned business, not just small. And that was my big inflection point into the diversity space. At large. From that, I got the VP position to do diversity, equity, and inclusion, which is not just supplier diversity. And that's kind of what led me here. So those two were really big ones because they really shaped the rest of kind of where my career went.
And I'm listening to that. And what I find so extraordinary about that is when you're in a family structure, and there's always a peer structure, and there's this compelling pressure to conform.
Yes.
And what I find extraordinary about you is in the face of that, you chose, my path, what feels true and right to me. I just think that is such a testimony about, when I talked about our team, I joke about us being a body and I might be the big toe, but I need a thumb and I need an elbow and I need you to do you, such that we all play our part and there needs to be humility in that, I would like to be the head, but it turns out I'm the elbow. Well, okay. You know what? Play your part because the body functions well when you do you. And if you spent too much time trying to conform to somebody else's expectations, you're not doing the job that you were built to do. What a great story about that.
You're absolutely right, Bea.
So when you're here with Medtronic, you've now been with the company for a couple of years, so you've gotten a sense of the organization. You've done some amazing things, and you've actually expanded your responsibilities. How are you putting your stamp on the work of an organization that's really quite big, and yet there's room for, change and growth? What does that look like from your perspective?
Well, big part of the credit as to why the things I will share with you took hold in terms of what I was bringing to the table is who Medtronic really is as a company. Medtronic was founded by Earl Bakken and a colleague, but Earl really was the designer of the Medtronic mission. He wrote it with his hands, right? And
in his garage,
right?
Overcommitting, overinvesting in the engine of the future. Yes.
Yes. Yes. And when investors came down on him and were like, what are you doing? Why are we doing this? He actually sat down and wrote the mission. Mm. And that mission is so anchored in what this company stands for and what it's all about. No matter whether it's having good days or bad days, the mission is the anchor. And the mission, two of its tenets. So tenet five is that we recognize the value of all employees.
Mm.
And the word all was actually added by our former CEO, Omar Ishrak. It said of employees, and he added the all, just so everybody knows, it's unequivocal that everyone is included. Mm-hmm. And then tenet six, which is to be a good citizen in community. And these were written over 60 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I came into an organization that had a really good foundation of understanding of the need to do good by your people and do good by your community.
Mm-hmm.
And they had been on this inclusion and diversity journey for several years before I came. The changes that I would suggest, and hopefully they agree with, that I brought to the table, were around two core areas. Number one is most companies who do ID&E have a philosophical approach that this is HR's work.
Mm.
And what I helped the organization understand is it's not HR's work. Mm. It is a business strategy and if for sustainability and innovation. And if it is so, then it is a leader-led strategy, not an HR-led strategy. And that really took hold. People, when we explained it, we explained the why, they really got that. And so we shifted to what we call a leader-led model. And leader-led means you're accountable, not only accountable, but your pocket is accountable. So tying executive, you know, VP and above compensation to inclusion, diversity, and equity goals was a big shift in that leader-led model towards ID&E as a business strategy. The second thing that we brought forward in the strategy that we designed, we have three pillars, you know, the individual, the company, and then the community. That community piece was a nice codification, so to speak, of something Medtronic believed in, but maybe hadn't codified explicitly as an agenda towards equity in our communities. How do we play a part in being a catalyst for change? How do we do our part in improving education for the underserved and so forth in a way that is comprehensive and supportive of the business strategies that we have? So adding that element of equity and what we call impact beyond our walls was another area that really just took hold here. And we've been doing some really cool work around.
Well, so let's talk about one of those. This is something that you and I have spent a lot of time talking about, because as soon as you shared this one particular body of work that is tying in your workforce as well as the broader community, as well as the undervalued, underseen, underrepresented community that we want to make sure no one's on the bench, right? So you shared this whole initiative with me and I was just captivated. I'm like, we have to bring this to visibility. Talk to us a little bit about this one project, the 110 initiative that you introduced me to, that I just find really, really forward thinking.
Thank you, Bea. And yeah, so we are founding members of the 110 initiative, which I'll share with you more about. We're also started our first ever relationship with Thurgood Marshall College Fund, a 5-year relationship with them, multi-millions, also with SHIP, the Society for Hispanic Engineers. And our foundation, 60-something percent of all of the funding through the foundation is now to enable education in STEM. So we have a lot of things going on. What's unique about what 110 is trying to accomplish is 110 is a commitment by CEOs across the country.
Leader-led commitment again.
Leader-led commitment again.
Yeah.
Like Ken Frazier and Ginni Rometty, former CEO of IBM, they came together and they reached out to CEOs and said, let us put together a path and an initiative to create together 1 million jobs over the next 10 years, but not just any 1 million jobs, skilled jobs for Black talent that have opportunity for promotion. So the idea of the initiative is really cool. They thought they'll get maybe 20, 30 companies, actually 56 CEOs signed up in the first year with multi-million dollar commitments. We've already put in more than $5 million into that initiative. But what it led internally in companies is what's most interesting too, which is if a company is committed to doing, to creating skill-based jobs, it has to lean into moving away from every job requires a college degree to skill-based assessment of job requirements. So in order for us to meet that commitment, we had to, for the first time ever, re-credential jobs. Go and look at, does this really need a 4-year degree or does it not? We've actually, many of our job description codes or whatever for our IT space have already been redefined for no college degree. And that also led to, well, if we want to allow for opportunity for promotion, if we're bringing in people without a college degree, could we support their skill building and their education building, which led us to launch our MAPS program, which is a debt-free degree. So Medtronic, if you join, we will pay for your degree. No strings attached when you are on your degree. Yes. And we had thousands of employees apply in the first month that we launched it. It was still in pilot, but thousands applied. And there's a video that's going to come out in our ID&E report next week that shows this, this 45-year-old man who it's just heartbreaking to listen to him say, I've been working for all this time. I'm 45. I never in my life thought I would have access to a college degree. And that's the kind of stuff, you know, the 110 initiative might be something over there, but what it takes for a company to meet those commitments and change the way it does things inside is what really where the magic and the beauty and the stuff that keeps you going, even though most days are hard.
So let's just pause on a moment of encouragement for you. Let's go all the way back to that inflection point. I wanted to change the world. The platform may have been healthcare in the medical space, but I wanted to make a difference. 30 years later, you get to talk to this gentleman who said, I never imagined, and you have changed the world. If only in one person, but you know, the one person is the world. You just do it again and again, right? That is extraordinary. You must feel great about that, seeing that at work.
I do. It's the stories like that that really make, like, you know, like we were saying, it's when you look back now and you go, why did I have to go through that? Or why was that?
Yeah.
Why did I have to go through these challenges? What gave me the conviction at the time to decide to do that?
Yeah.
And then you reflect and say, okay, maybe this is how I'm serving. This is maybe how the universe has wanted me to be in these places to serve in this way. You know, another lady in our supply chain area who works the lines, right? She's one of the hourly people who work the lines. And because of that job, she's been in her role for 12 years, never got a promotion. And the first time she ever got a promotion was through the work that we did to recredential the jobs. Her story is as well, just as beautiful. And it's those stories, B. It's that those stories, that those changing lives. I like how you say, you know, you're changing the world. That, you know, I think that's too big for what I'm doing. But we are changing individual people's lives. And I think when you change one life, you change, there's a ripple effect. So
I'm not wrong. And so I know you don't want to claim bigness. You can own smallness, which feels safer for a lot of us, but the outcomes are extraordinary. And I think that speaks to, I was just on the phone earlier today, talking to a person in the public affairs space. We were really struggling with a particular policy thing that wasn't working, you know, or disagreeing strongly. And this person's like, I'm out, you know, I just want to go retire and plant flowers, you know? And I'm like, no, we don't get to quit. The only thing that is assured in terms of no change is walking away. And we're not called to control the outcomes. We're called to control the effort. And what's in front of us is, with integrity and respect, wrestle. I use that word a lot because it's done with the intent for good and with love to the other person. And we're going to disagree. We're going to wrestle about stuff. And you must extend the effort. We're not in control of the outcomes all the time, because sometimes you get these amazing ones and you didn't know about that either. So very, very exciting. And, you know, it speaks to the fact that you see it this way is one of the things I admire about you in terms of your insightful nature. And so I wanted to ask you for some advice. Mm-hmm. So our annual meeting this year is focused all about tomorrow. I don't know what happened or when it happened, but I am yesterday. I woke up and I realized, oh my goodness, I'm yesterday. I need to know what tomorrow thinks, what tomorrow wants, what tomorrow needs, because in order for this organization to continue tomorrow, we need to be connected. And so spending a lot of time investing in young professionals and next generation and including everyone who wants room at the table, we're going to scooch and make room. I'd like to know your insight when you're a next generation leader and they're trying to find their way. What are some thoughts of encouragement you might have?
That's, you know, I love that question, B. And I'm going to be a little more personal on that one. I think so many of us who grew up in your and I's era defined success by what everybody else around us expected.
Mm-hmm.
What everybody else decided success means these things. And many of us who arrived at those things, when they arrived, were not happy individuals.
Mm-hmm. Amazing, isn't it?
Amazing, right?
Taking somebody else's dream, is it surprising it doesn't fit?
You know? It's surprising it doesn't fit. So fulfillment and making sure that when you arrive, it was what you wanted. The best advice I try to give young people is forget about what the world, what you think the world expects of you, mm-hmm. and find what lights you up. What is the thing that when you're doing, you're in flow? The thing that when you're doing, you feel it's not work, mm-hmm. you know? That's number one, really, really important. So that when you go the journey, you have a better guiding pole than people expected this of me, or this right. is what success right. looks like to other people. Right. Because most of us now will say mental health. If we could just like be happy in our brains, no matter what is going on outside, that would mm-hmm. be more success than I have X in the bank, an X size house, but I'm not finding the joy in life that I work this hard to get to. So that's my first, you know, don't arrive and then not have the full amount of joy that you wish to have. The second thing I would say is be an agent for what you want companies and business to evolve to, because mm. they're listening now with a different set of ears than they have ever in the past. Mm-hmm. I speak about this often, so I hope people, maybe if you've heard it from me before, don't get bored. But Larry Fink, who's the CEO of, why is the company missing my name? Big investment firm, Red Rock something.
BlackRock.
BlackRock, thank you.
Oh yeah, his research has been great. Okay, good, right. good.
And he writes a letter to CEOs every year. And last year, his letter said,
oh, yes, yes. Okay, good. Okay.
If organizations think that they just have shareholders to contend with, they will lose at their own peril. And the employees now are basically in the driver's seat. And companies who do not listen to their stakeholders, of which is the community and employee, they will completely miss the mark. So what I tell young talent is you have a much stronger and bigger voice than you might be giving yourself credit for. So use that voice to shape what you want to see in business and in companies going forward, because they are listening different. Mm. And the third thing I would say is be an ongoing learner. Mm. All of the new research in AI, artificial intelligence, is saying that huge sections of business are going to go away with AI. Huge. AI is going to do better accounting than most people. AI robots will do better surgeries than physicians. And this one thought leader at an event I was at a couple of years ago said, younger talent will need a different skill than we had. We were brick and mortar people. We wanted to go to college, have a career, build the house and brick and mortar and live there. The younger talent needs to operate under the, I have a tent and I can move it anywhere, which means you might think you're in a career and then you need to switch that career. And then you might need to switch that career. So the capacity to be a continuous learner and be okay with, well, I haven't done that before, but I can go learn it. really needs to be a skill set we instill in our young talent to not get too married to only one way of doing business, but to consistently evolve and learn and be agile in the change that will be upon us as AI takes hold in the next 10 years.
So I'm going to give a serious alert to anyone who comes to our annual meeting on March 2nd, 2023, by the way. When I use these lines, because I rip off and duplicate, the R&D and B. Kyle's world is brilliance coming from your mind, writing it down, stealing it. I love this idea of a tent that can move anywhere. And the idea about don't be too married to one way, evolving, agility. Really powerful, Sally. Oh my gosh, that's great. Thank you for that. And I couldn't agree more. And if there's anything someone my age needs to continue to remember is don't be too married to one way. Mm. There's more than one way to get to the path to get to where you need to go. Thank you for that.
Absolutely. I mean, yes, we can benefit, and that's where all the young talent is really, need to focus on. So, that's what we do, right? We provoke ideas, and then hopefully those ideas take hold and people can continue in dialogue and conversation. So we stay connected.
Before we go, I'm going to do a popcorn real quick. I'm going to ask you for, I'm all about traits or actions that strong leadership needs to demonstrate. And particularly now we're coming out of a season. And in my mind, we're entering a new season of real challenge, uncertainty. As you say, the tents are moving and folks are used to houses. We're not sure exactly what's happening and how to find our way. And so just give us the three or four key traits or actions a strong leader right now needs to demonstrate.
Absolutely. And these might be different than what people in the past used to think were the top key ones. I would suggest empathy. Number one. And that has emerged so solidly since COVID hit the world. Curiosity. Don't think you know it all. Stay curious. Okay. And in order to benefit from your curiosity comes my third one, which is actively listen.
Wonderful.
Those would be my three for leaders, because everybody around us can teach us something. And we have to let go of old leadership paradigms of the leader means they're the head. I loved how one you were describing is like, I'm the big toe and they can be the because so many leaders walk into things thinking they have to be the head when they might be the arm or the muscle or the something else. And they don't need to have all the answers.
And candidly, if you're smart and you hire people smarter than you,
you shouldn't.
You're the smartest. If you think you're the smartest person in the room, your company is in trouble.
Yes.
As big as you are, right? Yes.
And then you don't need people, you need drones.
Or artificial.
We would like to have people.
All right, we're running out of time. This just breaks my heart. I want to keep talking. Well, folks, Sally and I will keep talking long after this is over. But I just wanted to thank you publicly again, Sally, for talking with me. I know you're so, and you know what? I'm going to pause on that. We use the word busy as almost a defense, and we're not going to choose to. We all have lots of commitments. And we choose to invest in the things we care about, which is one another, this conversation. So thank you for making me a commitment in your day and for taking the time to share this with everybody else too.
And thank you, B. I was honored to have this time with you and really appreciated our conversation. Thank you.
So thanks all of you for joining us for B's Table Talk. And again, thanks to Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo is making these conversations possible. And we have more conversations in the week ahead. More business leaders, nonprofit leaders, creative thinkers, all investing in our region in new and different ways. And I look forward to sharing them with you. Have a great day, and we will see all of you in the trenches.